Hi there, Cameron Wilson joining you. Welcome to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia, also streaming online at abc.net.au/radio national. The beaches of Australia's southeast are covered in the rotting carcasses of mutton birds at the moment. The dead birds have been spotted from Coffs Harbour all the way to Tassie in the south. So what's behind the mass deaths? Stay with us. We'll discuss that a little later on the program. Also today, the latest World Weather Report. It was released just overnight. We'll discuss what's in it that matters for Australian farmers. We've got that and plenty more coming up today on Bush Telegraph. First, if you're a marketing expert, what do you make of this for a tough sell? Trying to tell ratepayers that if they want better roads and bridges, they need to pay for them, and that some bridges will be shut altogether and some sealed roads will be relegated to dirt. Now, you can just imagine the reaction to that. But that's the reality as outlined in the 2013 State of the Assets Report into Infrastructure that's been delivered to the Roads and Transport Congress this week. Jeff Rorter wrote the report and he spoke to me from Alice Springs.
It tells us that 12% of our transport infrastructure, roads and bridges, is in poor and very poor condition. And currently, local government doesn't have enough funds to manage all of that. So what we're going to start to do is monitor that and see if it gets worse, or also identifies where we can better target investment.
If you say the roads and bridges are in poor or very poor condition, what does that mean? Is it they're getting towards the end of their life?
That's exactly what it means. It means that they're within 10 years of the end of their life. Some of them are in very poor condition, and for bridges that means load limits and possible closure, and for roads it means that roads have progressed to a stage where we can't just do a resurfacing, we've got to fix the pavement underneath that's damaged.
And are we talking here about your local service roads and smaller bridges, or are we talking about main thoroughfares?
We're talking about all roads that are controlled by local government, and local government controls a very large proportion of the overall road network.
Is this across Australia? Is the problem nationwide?
Yeah, it is. It's right across Australia.
How did we get to this stage?
A lot of these infrastructure assets are very long lives and they're getting towards the end of their lives. Governments have been focusing on growth for a very long time, and some of these assets are getting close to the end of their lives, and that's starting to really hurt councils that haven't necessarily had the funds to be able to fund this from rates and fees and charges. Mm.
Felicity Ann Lewis is also with me. Felicity Ann is the president of the Australian Local Government Association. Felicity Ann, thank you for joining Bush Telly. Do the figures in this report come as a surprise or a shock to local governments?
No, I don't think they do. They build on some work that was done last year by Jeff on behalf of the Australian Local Government Association, which was a bit of a pilot, I guess, and used about 40-odd councils to gather some data, which gave us an indication that we were facing a significant challenge, which this further report, which is data now from 344 of the some 500-odd councils across Australia, and has really proved that we are in a perilous position with regard to our ability to continue to maintain and enhance the vital road assets across our nation.
So how many local councils would have the money needed to upgrade this infrastructure or improve it?
Well, I think we've had a good bit of money and support to do asset management planning, and I think councils have got many of them, not all, and I think the fact that we've got a 100-odd that weren't able to provide Jeff with the data indicates that I think he said they said that they were too busy to be able to do it, or they didn't have it, and so I imagine that these are the councils that really are at the pointy end of struggling to do this. But many of us, and particularly the bigger urban councils, understand the challenge that we have and have plans in place to be able to deal with that and replace our assets in a timely way. But certainly there are others who don't, and they are the people that we, the councils that we need to be lobbying hard for, that are actually able to get the funds that they need to maintain this important infrastructure.
What, lobbying state and federal governments for funds?
Well, that's right. I mean, local government collects 3% of the taxes collected in this nation every year, and the federal government collect 80%, and the state's about 20-odd. So it's, you know, we know where the money is, and I know whilst we appreciate that the federal government are having their own challenges, we have to look to the federal and state government for partnerships to actually provide this money. And of course local government would like to see it provided through programs such as Roads to Recovery and the new Bridges Renewal Project announced by the Coalition Government, which sees money coming directly to local government. But as Jeff rightly points out, it's not just about new highways being opened, and the Minister talked today in our video link about the new Bruce Highway. Whilst that's great, we've got to actually replace ageing infrastructure roads that we've taken for granted for the last 60, 70 years, and we have to renew those, and that will take significant investment.
Jeff, has the change in use of our roads been a factor in this?
Yeah, it's been a really big factor. A couple of mayors have said in the last couple of days they're used to having smaller wheat trucks and milk trucks, and now they look out and see B doubles and B triples. So the way we use our roads, and now a lot of roads have got combination of heavy vehicles and increasing tourist traffic. So roads that were built for the past aren't suitable for the future. So it's not just a matter of renewing what's there, it's also making sure we do smart investment in infrastructure to meet future needs for transport. Mm.
Now, Felicity Anne made clear there that some extra funds are being sought, but assuming that not all the money that's needed is forthcoming, what do you think the options are?
Well, the options are councils are using asset management plans and risk management plans to live within their means and best target the money they have to get the best possible, the best value result for their communities. But a council can only do what it can within its boundary, and it doesn't make sense to think of a transport network in little pockets like that. A transport network is a national network with a national hierarchy, so it needs a whole of government approach.
But has it reached the stage where some assets, the deterioration will have to be managed rather than straight out finding the money to improve the asset?
Yeah, that's happening with some councils. A lot of councils are now prioritising. Councils with timbered bridges are putting load limits on bridges. Some bridges have been closed. There are some councils who are prioritising which roads will have gravel and which won't have gravel. So when we look at 18% of gravel roads that are poor, very poor condition, that just means they don't have any gravel. And so if there's wet weather, there's depends on what kind of soil type you've got. School buses don't get to school and people don't get there till it dries out.
Things stop. Mm. Have you looked at what this costs in terms of the cost to transport industries or agricultural industries that need to get their produce from a regional area to the cities?
At this point, we haven't yet worked out the multipliers, but they're large. What we have worked out is that there's about $19 million worth of infrastructure in poor and very poor condition, and it's a matter of over the next 5 years working out how best to target that $19 million. If you look at benefit, cost and risk, there's a much bigger return than $19 million to whole of government for that investment. If we do nothing and let it go, the loss will be a lot greater than that. Mm.
You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN, also on Radio Australia. The voice you're hearing there is Jeff Rorter, who's compiled the 2013 State of the Assets Report. Also with me is Felicity Anne Lewis, President of the Australian Local Government Association. Felicity Anne, it'd be a difficult thing for local councils to do, wouldn't it, to tell the local ratepayers that some of your roads are just going to be not up to the standard they have been in the past?
Look, I think it is, and remembering that these people are elected people from within their own community who are having to make these really tough decisions. And, you know, I'm a mayor from South Australia and I've been the president there. And, you know, Kangaroo Island Council, for example, talking about many of their roads, which are, you know, primarily used for tourists, having to make decisions about which of those are going to be closed because they simply don't have the dollars to maintain them in a condition where they can say that they could safely see people transiting over those roads. So, you know, this, you're talking about the economic value to our community for things, not only tourism, of course, but we know farming, farm produce, services, mining, all of those things, and many of those assets, as Jeff's pointed out, are being consumed at a more rapid rate than what the earlier modelling suggested, and for many councils they're programming of works have had to be readjusted to deal with that. So, yes, these are very tough decisions, and it's not just about business. It's about social things such as schooling and those kinds of things, which communities rely on roads to get everywhere. From the moment you come out of your front gate, you're on a local road, and you need to have the ability to use that road all the time to go about your normal lifestyle. So, you know, it's a critical issue, and it's not new. We've known since about 2006 with the previous PricewaterhouseCoopers study, which told us back then that we had about a $14.6 billion backlog and funding gaps each year of about $1.1 to $1.2 billion. So, you know, we're not surprised by this. People might say, what have you been doing? We've been working really hard to try and get this message. And I think Jeff's work now gives us really good evidence to say why the three levels of government have to turn their attention to this in a really serious way.
I know on this program we've seen how emotive the debate gets around things like grain trucks or mining trucks sharing roads with tourists and local traffic that when it's deemed the road may not be up to scratch, not a safe road.
Well, that's true, and we've had presentation this morning from the National Heavy Vehicle Regulator, and you know, there's a lot of work going on there about national road reform and thinking about how we actually get that balance and actually get the particular user of the road actually being able to make contribution to that, and to count for councils to be able to make decisions about which roads are appropriate for which kinds of transport uses. And I think most local councils have heard about this for a number of years and have glazed over thinking it would never happen, but we're assured that it's going to happen, and it's going to happen early next year. It's had a few false starts, but they wanted to be sure that they had proof of concept that it was going to work and that it would deliver for local government and indeed also the states. But, you know, given we manage 80% of the roads, it's very critical for local government to be able to make those calls because they know their roads and their community and how it works best. And so we're hoping that then we'll also have some opportunities to get some road user charges down the track as well and be able to put that money into the roads which are being consumed more quickly and that are most used, so that those things can be targeted and specific and done through good evidence.
I wonder if that's more palatable to the local people than rate rises, road user charges.
Most definitely I think it would be, because it goes on that principle of if you use it, then you need to pay for it. And, you know, many people argue with me about the fact that they pay rates but they don't use the library or they don't use the swimming pool. Why should they? So whilst property-based taxes are a bit of a blunt instrument, we know because we've tried and looked at other models that it's the fairest overall. It's not without its problems. But we also know that if people do want to use those services, then they need to perhaps pay additionally because the rates just don't cover that. And I think the same is true for our roads.
There's that old adage, I'm sure you don't like it, that you know, the local council is in charge of roads, rates and rubbish. Is there any justification in the criticism that some local councils have strayed too far from that and put money into services that maybe that cash could have been redirected into these basic needs?
Look, I think every council is, you know, challenged every night that they meet in making decision about what it is that their community is saying that they want. And, you know, we've had a few people talk about this today. You know, councils represent and reflect what it is that the community say that they want. And you might look back now and say, well, you know, we should have spent more money on our road infrastructure. But I'm sure the council didn't just wake up one morning and think, oh, I think we should have a new library or we should have a new pool. That would have been done because councils have been lobbied by their communities to provide those infrastructure. And, of course, we know that the state government has walked away in many instances from the soft service, the human service provision out in our regions, and not only in our regions but our metropolitan areas as well. But we had a discussion at the ALGA board meeting yesterday about, you know, medical and health services that many country towns are having to provide housing for doctors to get them to be in their town. So, you know, local councils are in spaces that I don't think they would really want to be in, but if they don't step up to the mark, who's going to? Who's going to put those doctors out there to look after our people in our regions? They deserve to have that good service that we have and take for granted in the metropolitan area.
You're hearing from Felicity Ann Lewis, President of the Australian Local Government Association. Also with me is Jeff Rorter from Jeff Rorter and Associates. Felicity Ann, I take the point here that this is a nationwide problem and it's not something just restricted to rural areas and rural councils, but if ratepayers are going to foot some of the bill here, is it even more difficult for rural councils that would have a much smaller ratepayer base?
Oh, most definitely. And we know that many of these smaller councils out from the major centres are the ones who are more and more reliant on the federal assistance grants and other grants than, say, your big metropolitan council. So, you know, how many of them see their grants and their operating dollars consumed with governance and a number of the other things that they actually have to do. So they don't have a lot left to invest in the maintenance and even renewal of their infrastructure. So they are increasingly finding it tough, and many state, local government and territory associations have done quite extensive work on financial sustainability of local government, and it's not always small councils, but there's a significant proportion that are more remote, rural and regional, that are struggling to be able to remain sustainable, and that is, you know, when you take into account their assets and depreciation and all of those sorts of things. So it certainly is a challenge.
And the pressure they face, I guess, from agricultural landholders in particular that have been saying for years now we can't afford these continued rate rises.
That's right. So they're in a continual tension because no councillor really wants to put the rates up. I mean, we pay rates as well. Nobody wants to see that. So you're in that, you know, bind between knowing what it is that you need to be collecting. And I think Jeff was giving some really interesting figures about how many millions of dollars it would cost, you know, in rate rises. And that, I think there was a gasp from the audience, Jeff, when you presented that earlier today, saying to state governments, you know, well, we have to put the rates up by this amount. If you are serious that you believe that we need to fix this, this is what it will take. And we know that it's just people just can't afford to pay that. And particularly when you see the economy in a time when it's under pressure and everybody's struggling, and we've got, you know, our utilities charges continuing to go up, people just don't accept that their rates should have to go up. And, you know, we have to live with that. And as Jeff has said, we have to live within our means, but therefore we have to do some hard decisions about our priorities. And that comes back to the discussion we had earlier about, do we close particular roads? Do we not maintain some roads to a particular condition? You know, do we do the grading less often? All of those things are the decisions that councillors can take to try and mitigate against rate rises, but it comes at a cost.
Jeff, what was that figure that made the room gasp?
The dilemma for rural councils is that an increase for an urban council of a relatively small amount, like 5 to 10 or 20%, if you have to apply that same effect for a rural council that has much smaller population and lots more infrastructure, you have to multiply that by 2 to 3 to 4 times. And so to get the same effect, you have to get really big numbers, and they're just unreasonable numbers for rural communities because they have so much infrastructure for such a small population. And one of the primary areas there is that most of the economic benefit is primary produce, and most of the revenue from primary produce goes to the federal government. So land tax for rural community infrastructure doesn't make sense. It's a real problem for rural and remote communities in particular.
So a new model's needed?
Yes.
Yeah. Jeff, it seems like a gloomy report. Is there anything good to take out of this?
Yeah, there is. There is an opportunity to target expenditure now to get, based on benefit, cost and risk, to get a really good result. This is solvable, and in some instances the answer will be, because what we're also measuring is capacity of infrastructure and function and utilisation. So it's not just a matter of keep everything where it is. It's about how do we best target investment in infrastructure from whole of government, because it's the community doesn't tell a difference between taxes it pays to local, state and federal. It's all tax.
Yeah, it's money that's not yours anymore, yeah.
And so whole of government needs to say, how do we get a better result on infrastructure? And if we do that, we can actually get some really good results.
Well, Felicity, I guess you've got the ammunition now, don't you?
We do, and an evidence-based approach to me is the way that we need to be going, and I think now this gives us a very strong evidence base to talk to our state and federal governments to develop and build on the road reform projects that are coming our way in the next few months, and see what we can do to increase the quantum but also be a bit more strategic about those issues that have been highlighted. So that'll be our work, I'm sure, in the coming months.
Tough time to ask for more money. So I wish you all the best. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Felicity Ann Lewis, President of the Australian Local Government Association, and Jeff Warder from Jeff Warder and Associates. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN. Just before we head to rural news, we're getting a lot of comments on that story about the state of our roads on our Facebook page. We were asking if you're prepared to pay for better roads, whether that be through higher rates or paying using more taxpayer money. Dennis says we pay with our lives if we are unhappy to pay with our taxes. And Ryan agrees with that. Ryan says we're gambling with our lives on the bad ones. Brenton suggests reducing all the speed limit on all roads to 80 km and build rail networks to remove 75% of trucks. Stop B-doubles driving through towns and regional cities. Tax all imported goods that require road transport about 3% to help pay for it. Adam's got his sights on the management practices. He says it takes a carload of people to look for and mark potholes and faults, another group in the office to produce a plan to fix the problem, then it gets tendered out to the cheapest tender. What happened to the work crews just fixing the problems as they form? Me says, aren't we already paying for them with our car registrations and taxes? Stop the B-doubles driving on small country roads and upgrade our rail networks to take goods that require road transport. And Anna says, I thought we already do pay. Perhaps the four-wheel drivers ought to pay for the amount of road they take up and use. There's just some of the comments coming in. Felicity Ann from the Local Government Association raised the prospect there of a user-pay system, especially for heavy vehicles. Keen to know what you think of that via our Facebook page. Also, would you rather some roads in rural areas be closed rather than allowing them to deteriorate to dangerous levels? Let us know what you think at facebook.com/bushtelegraph or at rnbushtele on Twitter. We'll have the detail from the World Meteorological Organization's report that came out overnight in a moment. But first, Tony Allen's with me. Tony, I heard Joe Hockey on Fran Kelly this morning with plenty to say about Kevin Rudd, but we want to know about GrainCorp. Did he say much about the GrainCorp sale?
He said a little bit. He was asked about what he would do by December the 17th, where he has to decide whether to approve the bid for GrainCorp from American agribusiness Archer Daniels Midland. Now, that $3 billion bid is strongly opposed by grain grower groups in eastern Australia, the National Party as well, and some Liberal MPs too, in country seats. But Mr. Hockey, who did approve unconditionally the Canadian bid for Warrnambool cheese and butter just yesterday, is saying the national interest question does weigh heavily over whether he's going to approve the sale of GrainCorp to a foreign buyer, but he's not ruling it in or out.
My job is to ensure that a foreign investment is not contrary to the national interest, and it is a powerful test. It weighs heavily, but I'll do what's right for my country.
And he did say the other day that he wouldn't be bullied into a decision, which is being interpreted by some as a message to the National Party.
Okay, he's not giving away too much just yet, though, is he? Still on GrainCorp, the company's got its results out today. I think, how's the company faring?
Yes, well, it's an interesting time to bring out your results, and the company has reported a big drop in its annual profit. Earnings for GrainCorp fell by 31% last financial year to $141 million. Now, the reasons for this, there's two main ones. One is that some of the money was used to purchase other companies, including an oilseed processor called Gardner Smith, but there was also a 17% fall in the size of the grain crop in the eastern states. And GrainCorp's Chief Executive Alison Watkins says drought in Queensland and northern New South Wales is cutting the yields in those regions, and recent frosts have also affected many areas further south.
Okay. You seem to have grain on the brain today, Tony. You've been looking at the South Australian harvest as well.
Staying mainly on the plain today. Mm-hmm. And in South Australia, we've got a report out from the state's Department of Primary Industries, and it estimates the grain crop there will be 8.9 million tonnes with an export value of $2.8 billion. Now, that's very good. And in fact, South Australia, which hasn't really been hit by drought or particularly inconvenient rains or frosts, is going to have its third largest grain harvest on record. That's providing, according to the department's Dave Lewis, that frost and wind do keep away until it's all cut.
The only things that might still cause grief is rain or very strong winds and hot conditions. It's only safe once the grain is in the silo, as everybody knows, but certainly we're now in a lower risk period than we were, say, during spring when we had hot conditions and finishing conditions being unfavourable for the crop to reach its full potential.
Okay. Yeah, the weather has been all over the place.
Quantity is only half the story, though, isn't it? You need it to be good quality as well. So we'll keep
it's generally looking good in South Australia. Yeah.
All right, so we'll keep an eye on that as well. Thanks, Tony. Tony Allen with Rural News there. Also making news today is the latest weather report from the World Meteorological Organization, and it might mean Australia's farmers need to rethink traditional agricultural districts as a warming planet sees cropping, vineyards and other industries move further south. The organisation is tipping 2013 to be in the top 10 of warmest years since records began, which is in the mid-1800s. Kath McAloon has the details.
The United Nations World Meteorological Organization has compiled data on global temperatures and weather trends for the year to date. Its reporting 2013 is on track to rank among the top 10 warmest years since modern weather records began back in 1850. Much of that is because of record hot temperatures in Australia.
Australia was probably the most exceptional part of the world this year.
Blair Truen, a climatologist with the Weather Bureau. The UN organisation says this year's data continues a long-term warming trend, with all of the warmest years to date occurring since 1998. The trend is so strong that the coldest years now are warmer than the hottest years before 1998. Blair Truen says Australia remains on track to record its hottest ever year this year.
The year so far in Australia has been the warmest on record by a fairly substantial margin. Up till the end of October, we're running 0.24 of a degree ahead of the previous record year, which means that unless November and December are significantly cooler than normal, 2013 will be Australia's warmest year on record.
The World Meteorological Organization data also points to impacts on the water cycle, with droughts, floods and extreme precipitation. Snow Barlow, a professor of agriculture at Melbourne University, says Australian farmers have to get used to farming in a hotter and potentially drier climate.
The globe is getting warmer, and inexorably our agricultural systems are going to have to adapt to what it will be, higher temperatures, and it will depend on where you are, but in some cases less rainfall.
He says the warming trend has already changed the landscape of Australian farming, with cropping areas shifting into more southern parts and vineyards looking towards Tasmania for premium sites. And it's likely it will change even further.
In aggregate, I don't think we've probably seen a contraction in agricultural land yet. I don't think we're seeing land abandoned yet in Australia and indeed around the world. But as you know, as the temperature builds above 1 degree, you see we're just about at 1 degree global warming above the 1960 to 1990 levels now. We're sort of 0.9 degrees. You know, if we went to 2 degrees, which we're on an inexorable path to now, we will see more changes.
Professor Barlow says farmers who are so reliant on the weather need to plan for a changing climate.
Farmers need to be engaged. I think it's very important in this to be aware of how the climate is changing. There is sometimes a tendency to talk about it in climate variability, but I think that's a dangerous way to go forward, because it gives the farmers, who are the people with the biggest stake in this, the view that the climate will go back to what it might have been 30 years ago. Well, I think what the evidence is, that's probably not the case. They will need to be thinking about how they're going to continually adapt as they move forward, and they're pretty good at that. So it's a matter of engaging them in the discussion, and many of the industries, such as the viticultural industries, are highly engaged. There are surveys showing that 70 or 80% of Australia's wine grape industry is one, accepts climate change, but two, are looking at how they might modify their management to adapt to it.
Snow Barlow, Professor of Agriculture at Melbourne University, ending that report by Kath McAloon. The comments are still coming in on what to do about our deteriorating road network, road network that apparently we can't afford to fix. That story was earlier. It'll be up on our website this afternoon if you missed it. Morella is the latest to add to the discussion. How about we invest in rail instead, as rail is more environmentally friendly? Quite a few of you suggesting that rail is where the money should be headed. If you've got a view, go to facebook.com/bushtelegraph or at RNBushTelly on Twitter. Seeing and hearing the effects of Typhoon Haiyan on Southeast Asia makes you wonder what we can do to help. One thing Australia is doing is sharing its experience of how the media can be used to encourage people to prepare for, deal with, and recover from natural disasters. The ABC's Rowan Reid will bring together officials from Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, and the Philippines next week in a two-day workshop being held in Phnom Penh. Judy Kennedy asked Rowan how prepared the people of the Philippines would have been for this latest disaster.
They do have various levels of coordination, but that sort of depends on the area involved, and a lot of it is done very much at the community level, because you're talking about, particularly in the Philippines, very isolated island populations where they might be in a village which is not well connected to the rest of the world. So they have to sort of fight for themselves a little. So they have their own town systems, you know, where the local mayor will organise systems and put in place procedures. But one of the issues that they faced, and one of the probably the most destructive part of this disaster, certainly in the Philippines, was not so much the wind, but the storm surge. And from what I have heard from people over there, the communities just weren't prepared for a wave or waves of, you know, a couple of stories high.
Mm.
So that really limits the capacity of people to do anything. That they, if they stay put, they're probably going to get hammered.
In a way, that reminds me of Black Saturday, where there were significant preparations put in place, significant warnings put out through the media, but no one was prepared for a 1-in-100-year bushfire. When you hold this workshop in Phnom Penh, will countries like Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos look at putting in some form of preparation like the public broadcaster does in Australia, where you're constantly hearing, we call them in the trade promos, where they're saying, make sure you clean up around your house before the bushfire season, make sure you are aware of flood levels or what's going to happen, what your plan is in a flood. Is that in place in Asia?
Not really. There's a lot of effort by a number of NGOs and by governments and national disaster organisations, but at this stage, there doesn't seem to be that campaign over a year or long-term campaigns that start to educate the community about and what to do and allow that community to develop its own systems. But I do think following this disaster, we're likely to see that ramped up much more. Now, it will certainly be much more effective in places like the Philippines because they have the infrastructure to be able to do that. But in places like Myanmar or Laos or Cambodia, they don't have the history with it, so it will take some time for them to build up that sort of level of coordination and campaign approach.
The other thing about coordination too is the ability to bring together all the emergency authorities and the Bureau of Meteorology, so you're getting that shared information that can be put out at speed to residents in a time of disaster. I would have thought that a number of these radio stations, or particularly, you know, Radio Khmer or the radio system in Vietnam, would be government controlled. Is that going to be an issue?
The government control, in the case of, say, Vietnam, is very effective, and so much so that they were able to use their media and also their other forms of communication to evacuate something like 700,000 people. Now, that's a huge logistical effort, but they managed to do that in preparation for this typhoon. So it's certainly possible in the government context. In places like Cambodia, Laos and Myanmar, where the systems of government and approaches are not as refined as they are in Vietnam, it's a slower process. And one of the problems with government owned institutions is that they have quite rigid editorial lines of control. So a message has to come in, go all the way to the top, be approved, and then come back all the way down again. And that slows the information dissemination, particularly when information needs to be so timely.
Mm. And that was a situation too with the ABC, which had a emergency information agreement with the CFA in Victoria on Black Saturday, where the CFA communications went down and the ABC was not broadcasting anything that hadn't been approved by the CFA. So it's very interesting to see that situation happening in Asia as well.
That's true. And I think one of the things that's happened in the countries where the governments are much more formalised and the communication systems are more formalised, the broadcasters are less willing to use information from the public. They want official information only. And sometimes you'll find, and I think Black Saturday is an excellent example of where it was community information or public information that was much more up to date than a lot of the government information, just because people are there on the ground seeing it and they can respond immediately to it.
Yes. And is that the fact that these developing countries haven't succumbed to citizen journalism yet?
So in the Philippines, it's a totally different scenario. There, you know, their social media use, and the same in Indonesia as well, their social media use is out of control. Everyone's on Facebook and a lot of people are on Twitter as well. So they do have a very good amount of public dissemination of information. That's not necessarily the case, well, it's definitely not the case in countries like Laos, Cambodia and Myanmar, just because the 3G networks, you know, the infrastructure is not there to the same degree. In Vietnam, the government there controls social media much more, so that public discourse is managed. And I would imagine during a disaster, they would open that up much more, but I don't know at this stage.
And resources is another issue. You also talked about infrastructure. In a huge flood from the typhoon, these storm surges that we saw in the Philippines this week, how secure are media installations like transmitters to get information out at a critical time in the midst of the disaster?
In the Philippines, most the infrastructure was wiped out. So, and from what I can tell, the communication systems have not been reinstalled in or repaired in most parts of the worst affected areas. So that information is gone. However, there are US ships, warships in the area which are broadcasting now to try and help these communities. But yes, infrastructure is a huge problem. And when I spoke to the people in Laos and Cambodia, one of the issues in the provincial areas is that their transmitters do not have generators. So as soon as the mains power goes, that's it, they're off air.
Mm. What about cross-country assistance then, and all its inherent challenges? If Cambodian communications went down, would your ultimate goal be to see a scenario where perhaps Vietnam could help out with emergency broadcasting?
That would be ideal. The problem is you deal with language barriers and
political barriers.
All these countries have tenuous relationships with each other, much like Australia does with a number of its neighbours. It's very hard to be able to coordinate that and go through the various protocols fast enough to be effective at this stage. But I think in the long term, we'll start to see much more of that.
In terms of sharing information from Australia, how is that going to be used to help the recovery process? I'm thinking, I guess, of the ABC set up a community radio station in King Lake, one of the communities that was absolutely wiped out by Black Saturday. Could you see a situation, or would you be encouraging dialogue between these countries about the possibility of setting up regional radio stations or going out into areas like, say, Battambang in Cambodia and putting in a recovery effort there?
I think that that would be fantastic if that can happen, and certainly some of the regional representative bodies are trying to encourage that sort of an approach. Again, it will depend on resources, and I think what you'll generally find is most of the money goes into direct assistance in the likes of food, medical supplies, and rebuilding destroyed infrastructure.
Mm.
But I think there is a lot of opportunity to expand upon that and help communities help themselves more by actually allowing the community to get on these smaller radio stations, talk about their issues, and communicate with each other so that they start to resolve some of their problems internally rather than just putting their hand out for more money.
And just finally, do you think that the people you've spoken to on the ground, I understand you've been doing quite a bit of legwork ahead of this workshop, do you think that people are appreciative of what they could possibly learn from a public broadcaster with emergency authority networks like the ABC, or do they think, well, you know, you're only broadcasting to a population of 20 million, of whom probably a couple of 100,000 can be affected at any one time? When you take a look at the Philippines, it's David and Goliath, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think part of what we're trying to do with this workshop is talk about the broad theories that we have developed in Australia and have been developed elsewhere. You know, as I said earlier, Vietnam has a very good system in place. Now, what we need to do is pick out the fundamental points of why those systems work and then talk with the people on the ground. So what we'll do at the workshop is basically come up with a broad template for them to start to build these plans and for them to assist them in working out how to build better communication networks. You know, some of the case studies we're looking at will be the Philippines and Vietnam in this most recent typhoon, but also we're looking at Bangladesh, where there was massive evacuations for a big storm earlier this year. So, you know, it's not like the ABC's invented it, or what's going on in Australia is where it's been invented. This has been going on for a while in a lot of places, and so what we're trying to do is adapt the lessons learnt from disasters all over the world and allow countries to develop systems which will best suit their capacity and needs.
And it's not only one-way traffic, is it? Because you would anticipate we'd have a bit to learn from Asia as well.
Certainly, and particularly with this disaster that's just happened in the Philippines, we're talking about storm surges of two stories. Now, that sort of storm surge we really haven't seen before in Australia. Now, what they will learn out of the lessons that can be learnt out of this particular disaster will be applicable in Australia's cyclone-affected areas where storm surge is obviously going to be an issue. So that the types of messages that they will now adapt to prepare communities for storm surge will be types of messages that we could start to include in an Australian context.
Rowan Reid, coordinator of the Disaster Response and Risk Reduction Media Workshop, speaking to Judy Kennedy from Bangkok. You're listening to RN, Cameron Wilson with you, also Radio Australia and streaming online. We've been asking you what should be done to fix the deteriorating road network that's affecting so much of regional Australia at the moment. We had a story on this earlier in the program that will be up for podcast on the website later today if you missed it. There's a lot of support coming in on our Facebook page for more investment in rail instead of more money going into improving roads. Susan's the latest to go into bat for rail over road. She says, isn't it becoming clearer and clearer every day? All goods ought to be moved via rail, traditional and light rail networks. Roslyn has some concerns about that, though. Roslyn says, if we are going to increase rail use to get trucks off the roads, they need to address the noise problems with trains. I live in a so-called quiet country town, but the screeching of the many long goods trains during the evening and the night is way above acceptable levels. There's some of the views coming in to our Facebook page, facebook.com/bushtelegraph. Well, the stench of rotting seabirds has replaced the fresh sea breeze on many southeastern Australian beaches at the moment. I've just been chatting with Kath McAloon, who you hear on our rural news from time to time. She was on a beach in far eastern Victoria, and she said it was just covered in rotting bird carcasses. Mutton birds, that are also known as short-tailed shearwaters, are in the middle of an annual migration from Siberia to the southeast coast of Australia to breed. But this year, many of them are actually not making the distance. Wildlife officer with the Department of Environment and Primary Industries, Stan Williams, has been watching this phenomenon for 25 years. Stan, thanks for joining us on the program.
Hello.
Is this year worse than any others for bird deaths?
They vary. We have these die-off events about every 3 to 7 years sometimes, but they coincide with the birds take off and do 15,000 kilometres in one single hit when they decide to come back, but they have to feed up before they come down, and usually off Japan is about where they feed. If there's not enough food there, obviously they exhaust themselves. They lose about half their body weight in that flight, and when they arrive here, if they're in a weak condition and are unable to feed here, they die and get washed ashore.
Okay, so what, there's a shortage of food, or you think there's a shortage of food in Australia and Japan?
Well, the condition that they arrive in depends on the food they've had just before they fly down. And if it's in short supply and it's up around off Japan there, they'll get here with less than half their body weight and are unable to feed when they get here.
Okay, so if this normally happens every 6 to 7 years, is that just because bird numbers have built up to an extent where there's not enough food to go around?
Yeah, well, there's roughly about 23 million about. They're the most abundant seabird. Matthew Flinders is reported to have counted 100 million in a single flock in Bass Strait. So apparently there was more about.
he counted 100 million, did he?
Yeah, he counted 100 million in a single flock in Bass Strait as he sailed through them.
So do they all come from Siberia? Is that the main starting point for this journey?
No, they winter up around the Aleutian Islands, Russia, Alaska, Siberia, and up in the north of the Pacific there. And they do a big, huge figure of eight when they leave Australia. And they head off in April. The adults leave here in April, and then the fledglings leave in May. They feed them up until they're about to fledge. Then they leave, and then it's like having a baby going home, and then the baby turns up at home.
So
take off after them, they don't have the adults to follow.
So how do the babies know where to go if mum and dad have already taken off?
Well, if you
flown the coop,
that I'm sure a lot of people would love to know.
So that's just something you don't know about them?
No, we don't know how they do it.
Do you know what's so why the southern coastline of Australia, the southeast coastline of Australia, is so suited to them?
Oh, we've got the upwellings that occur this time of year that the whales take advantage of. They feed on krill, small squid, arrow squid and crustaceans. And studies done early in the season, there's a few small plastic particles in their bodies, but later in the season there's less, so they must wake up to it.
Okay. You're listening to Bush Telly here on RN. My guest is Stan Williams, Wildlife Officer with the Department of Environment and Primary Industries, and we're discussing the large number of mutton birds that are being washed up dead on the beaches of southeastern Australia this year. If you've spotted mutton birds in an unusual spot, or if you've got a question for Stan yourself, at RN Bush Telly is our Twitter account. I've got that open now with an eye on it. So send in your tweets. Stan, I haven't got my head around, though, why it's happened after only 3 years this time, this large-scale bird deaths, when it normally happens every 6 to 7. I understand the feed might be in short supply, but why? Why after only 3 years this time?
It varies between those times. So I think it just depends on the El Nino event, and the ocean has seasons a bit like on land, so we have some productive years and some that aren't so good. We've just come through a big drought on the land here, and the oceans do the same thing.
Okay, all right. I've heard various theories, though, that maybe the unusual spring weather, late spring weather in parts of eastern Australia means the winds might have made the journey tougher for the birds. Any truth in that?
Yes, that is a big factor. The factors are they've got to eat enough to get their body weight up to about 500 grams they leave at. So if they leave with less than that weight, their body weight when they get here is less than half, and they're only the strongest survive. They do about 64,000 kilometres a year flying.
Yeah.
So, and they've only got about a 100 centimetre wingspan. They're only a little bird.
64,000 kilometres a year, and they're only, what, 500 grams and a reasonably small wingspan. That's pretty amazing stuff, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, they do amaze me at times.
Even after 25 years, you're still amazed.
Yeah, when they turn up, it's just incredible, the feat that they do.
Yeah. So you look forward to that each year, do you?
Yes. Yeah.
How do you feel, though, when you see these large-scale bird deaths? I understand it's part of the cycle, but it's still a little sad from your point of view to see so many dead birds washing up?
Oh, yeah, it's very sad, but it's nature sort of controlling itself, I guess. If the food supply is if the birds increase in numbers past the available food, they die off and the food's able to recover, or the food species.
Mm.
Just the balance of nature.
Yeah. You talked about how much plastic might be in their bodies earlier. There's been a theory kicking around that there's maybe the effect of plastic in the ocean is playing a role here. Do you subscribe to that theory?
Well, the studies that I've read up on, early in the season they find small bits of plastic. They don't eat large bits, and they're able to pass that. And early in the season there's quite a few bits and pieces turn up in their stomachs, but later in the season they find that they're ingesting less. The birds that have, over the years, we've done autopsies on the birds that have come ashore that were not too badly decomposed.
Mm.
In all cases, we've found that starvation was the cause of death. There's been no disease outbreaks or any other reason for them to die.
Okay. So they die at sea and then they get washed up. That's the way it works.
Oh, some do. Some turn up on... They get washed ashore and they're still alive, but they're unrecoverable because their body weight's so low and their organs are damaged from... Or they lose muscle condition. Once they burn their fat reserves, they start to burn their muscle, and they won't recover from that.
Mm. Okay, so what, you spend a bit of your time wandering around the beaches trying to find dead birds that aren't too decomposed so you can have a look in their tummies, do you?
We do that as a matter of course, just to make sure that we've got no diseases or any other impacts on them, just as part of the job.
Mm, okay. A lot of the people that live around this part of Victoria where some of the birds have washed up are fans of the penguins, the little penguins in particular. How do the mutton birds compare in your eyes to the penguins?
Oh, they're both fantastic in their own way. The best part about it is that it doesn't happen all that often, and you know it's nature at work, it's not us causing it.
Mm, okay, so there's no reason to be too disappointed, unless, of course, you've gone to the beach and you thought you'd have a good weekend away and you've got the stench of thousands of dead birds.
Yeah, well, mostly on the populous beaches where people go, the manager of that area, whether it be Parks Vic or a local manager, they usually clean it up so that people can still have a good experience.
Mm. What do you do? Just get a dozer or something?
Oh, I think they just run along with bags and pick them up. They're only small, and you can pick them up pretty easy with a shovel. But where they come ashore and it's not a populated beach, they decompose pretty rapidly because it's 150 grams of them or less.
It doesn't take too long.
They don't hang around for ages, and seagulls and ravens and other things predate on the corpses, and they disappear pretty quick.
Yeah, okay. You get a few more flies on the beach when there's rotting carcasses all along the sand?
Oh, I think there might be a few.
Yeah.
There'll be other things that eat the flies, so it all goes around, doesn't it?
It all works well. All right, Stan, look, thanks for your insights. Really interesting chatting with you.
You're welcome.
That's Stan Williams, Wildlife Officer with the Department of Environment and Primary Industries, speaking about the mutton birds that fly 15,000 kilometres all the way from Siberia and Alaska via Japan to Australia. Pretty amazing stuff, really, isn't it? That'll do us for the program today. Remember, you can keep that discussion going about the state of our rural roads by visiting our Facebook page, facebook.com/bushtelegraph. Stay on RN. News is next. That'll be followed by The World Today. Cameron Wistamano, I'll see you tomorrow.
Rose Hiscock's the head of the Powerhouse Museum, but when she was a child, the family business was running the tourist attraction and open-air museum, Sovereign Hill.
From the age of about 12 onwards, I think I went through every costume. I started off as a street urchin, and by the time I moved to university, I was one of Lola Montez's call girls.
Rose Hiscock is on Sunday Profile. Download the interview at the RN website.